The Brian McClanahan Show, episode 248.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to the Brian McClanahan Show.
Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Brian McClanahan. Like my Facebook page at Brian McClanahan. And of course, subscribe to my YouTube page at Brian McClanahan, where you can watch this podcast. If you don't want to search for all those social media buttons, just go to my webpage, brianmcclanahan.com. That's B-R-I-O-N, McClanahan.com. While you're there, give me an email address and I will give you a free ebook, Forgotten Founders, and a free audiobook of the same title read by yours truly. You'll get on my email list and you'll get a few emails here and there. I don't send a lot, but you're going to get some. You can also support the Brian McClanahan Show by going to McClanahanAcademy.com, where it's always free to enroll. And when you do enroll, you get a free course, 10 Myths of American History. Just check your email after you enroll. That's how it comes to you. And, of course, anyone who does enroll gets the best deals on forthcoming courses. Now, I've got a new course. If you're listening to this podcast, on July 31st, 2019, I have a new course coming up tomorrow. August 1st is the official launch day of my newest course, U.S. History to 1865. It is going to be one great course, or it is a great course already. It's 54 lectures, the longest and most comprehensive course I've ever done. It has lesson plans, quizzes, exams. So you can use this course as a homeschool curriculum for half the year. It's 18 weeks. So you've got half the year. The other half is being produced as I speak. So by the fall, you will have an entirely comprehensive U.S. history course to use for your homeschool curricula if you're looking for that. If not, if you're just a lifelong learner and you want to learn more U.S. history and get my perspective on things that I don't talk about in my other McClanahan Academy courses, you can do that. So it's a great course, 54 lectures, reading suggestions, reading seminars. I actually have some primary material that I put up there. We go through that in the reading seminar. So it's a lot of great stuff. It's not just lectures on a survey, but there is some other material to it. So you're going to want this class. And when I release it, you will get a good deal on it, and that deal will go away eventually. But you want to be looking for that. So if you're getting this, again, July 31st, 2019, tomorrow the course comes out, it launches. Make sure you're looking for that. An email, it will come to you. That's a great way to support the Brian McClanahan Show. You can also do so by going to LearnTrue, T-R-U-E, LearnTrueHistory.com. That is my affiliate link for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. A lot of great stuff there. There's several courses coming out there as well in the next few weeks. So it's going to be it's a great bang for your buck. I do teach there with Tom, of course, and Kevin Goodsman, Brad Berzer, Jason Jewell, Bob Murphy. A lot of great people there. It's just a wonderful class and website, I'm sorry, with a lot of great classes, over 20. So you want to get that too. And of course, you can always throw a few pennies my way by going to brianmcclanahan.com/support. You can either give me a donation or you can buy a book plate for your Brian McClanahan books that I can then send you an autograph. All right. So let's talk about today. This is a really interesting article, and it came to me. I saw it about three or four times on social media, and I knew I had to talk about this thing because it's really funny how this is being portrayed. Now, I saw it in one particular case on social media where the Twitter historians who like to rib Dinesh D'Souza. I mean, look, Dinesh D'Souza says a lot of stupid things. He also says some things that are fine, but he is an ardent Abraham Lincoln defender. And so anytime you can rib him over Abraham Lincoln, you will. But what this one of the people who posted, and I saw it, said, look, this essentially proves Brian McClanahan was correct. So you see, what this article does is validate everything that anyone who's been critical of Abraham Lincoln for years is correct. But the funny thing about it is that this is now a badge of honor. You see, for years, we've been saying things like, look, Lincoln was admired by the American communists. Lincoln was at least sympathetic with what were called the Red Republicans. These are communists, the 48ers, the German 48ers, who came over to the United States following the German revolutions of 1848 and set up shop here and became Republicans. They were called the Red Republicans. These people were communists. They were socialists. And everyone recognized it. In fact, I remember reading a letter from Judah P. Benjamin to James Byard when I was writing my dissertation. And Benjamin and Byard were friends. And Judah P. Benjamin remarked that one day, perhaps we will be free of black republicanism and you'll be free of red republicanism. Now, of course, that term black republicanism was used in the South to define those Southerners believed were egalitarians. But the red Republicans, he pointed this out. He's saying, look, in the North, you've got these red Republicans. Now, who are the 48ers? Well, I mean, one of the most famous, there's a couple of pretty famous ones. Probably the most famous culturally was a man named Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast was a German immigrant, but he was a cartoonist, and he published widely throughout the North in all the major weekly publications. Harper's Weekly, for example, he published in all of that. He published everywhere, but he was widely popular. And when you look at Thomas Nast's cartoons, this guy was a Republican. He did not like the Irish. He did not like Catholics. He did not really, I mean, look, immigrants were okay as long as they were German. But once you got away from Germans, no, he was a firm Union supporter during the war. He thought the South was backwards and needed to be reformed. But Nast was drawing cartoons that portrayed the Irish in Boston as apes. He portrayed Catholic bishops as alligators looking to consume good Americans on the shores of public school, where the public school is falling in ruin and the flag was upside down, among others. He's also the guy that popularized the idea of the Republican, the elephant for the Republican Party. He's the one that came up with that as an elephant stomping on the planks of the Democrats. So, I mean, the symbol of the Republican Party came from this Thomas Nast 48er. A lot of people don't know that, but he was a red Republican. He was a socialist. So the image that we have of the Republicans was created by a socialist. And then you have people like Carl Schurz, who was a Union general during the war. He came up with the kindergarten movement here in America. Now, we have to remember that in Germany, you had compulsory public education before you had it in the United States. In fact, children could be marched off at gunpoint in Germany if they didn't want to go to school. Now, today, you're not marched off at gunpoint, but your parents can certainly be thrown in jail if you don't go to school. But that's a German creation, compulsory public education. And Carl Schurz was the founder of the kindergarten movement, right? So he was a Marxist. He was a 48er. And you had many of them. Joseph Wiedemeyer was another one, a Marxist revolutionary. So you had, there's a whole slew of these people, but certainly they were influential in the Republican Party, particularly in the Midwest, where a lot of them settled. It's not a stretch to say this, right? But this particular piece is hilarious because what this thing is doing is just celebrating the fact that Abraham Lincoln might have dabbled with Marxism. This is in the Washington Post. Okay, so the Washington Post, you know the agenda, you know what it is. But the title of this particular piece is this. You know who was into Karl Marx? Not AOC, Abraham Lincoln. Now, you would look at that title and think, my gosh, the Post is actually going to talk about something real. They're going to actually criticize Abraham Lincoln for being a Marxist. No, no, no. This is a celebration of Abraham Lincoln being a Marxist, or at least dabbling with Marxism. Now, they do say that Lincoln was not a Marxist, and I agree. Lincoln wasn't a socialist, but he certainly was a centralizer, you see, and that's why Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln liked each other. That's why they saw eye to eye on things, because Lincoln was a centralizer. The only way that's going to work is through centralization, and Lincoln certainly was a nationalist in the same way that Daniel Webster was a nationalist, the same way that Alexander Hamilton was a nationalist, or John Marshall, or Joseph Story. They did not believe that the Union was anything but a mass of one people, that the states were really irrelevant at the end of the day, and that the Constitution created a national government. Now, that type of viewpoint is necessary for Marxism to take root. It cannot take root otherwise. Now, certainly you could say, well, what about California? It's a socialist state. Well, it is. Okay, so it's not affecting anywhere else, right? Just California, if we can keep it that way, right? So the central government with defined powers, delegated powers over commerce and foreign policy could never really be a socialist government because it wouldn't have the authority to do anything that socialism requires. But once you centralize power, once you do that, you can create a socialist government. And it's what we have in the United States now. Look, I mean, a lot of the things we have are socialist. If you look at the Communist Manifesto, you know, it calls for a graduated income tax. Cha-ching. It calls for, you know, compulsory public education. Cha-ching, we got that. You know, it calls for the abolition of private property, and people would say, well, we haven't abolished private property. Are you sure about that? Because in the United States, I mean, if you have, in some states, if you have a pond in front of your house or even a puddle that appears for a time, that can be classified as a wetland and you can't do anything with your property. Can you buy property and do anything you want with it? No. I mean, there are regulations about how you can buy it, how you can sell it, what you can do with it, who you can sell it to, who you can't sell it to. I mean, there's all kinds of things. So that's all part of socialism. It's what Marx advocated in the Communist Manifesto. So we've got it in the United States. And there's many other things as part of that, too. You know, the government control of telecommunications and transportation. Now, you know, people say, well, the government doesn't control that. Are you sure? I mean, can you just go on? Can I just start a radio station, start talking and over the airwaves? Now, of course, I'm doing this on a podcast, which has changed everything. But certainly, I can't just open up a radio station. I have to get an FCC license, and then I have to. They're going to monitor content. They're going to see what I'm doing. I mean, that's all government control of telecommunications. They control your television. They control what goes on that. They control what goes over the radio. They control. They're trying to control what goes over the internet because that's the one area they can't control yet. They control telephone communications. They control all of that. So, I mean, are you sure the government doesn't control communications in the United States? Now, at this point, the internet is controlled by big corporations, big tech, which they're controlling what people do, at least to an extent. So, you know, you have that. You know, Google is manipulating people. We all know this. So it's we have, and of course, Google and the government, while the government's making a lot of noise that they want to regulate Google. I mean, look, these people pay millions and millions and millions of dollars a year to ensure that their viewpoint gets in the government somehow. So, you know, transportation. Can anyone just go drive a car? No, you have to have a license to do so. I mean, so the government controls these things, which is exactly what Marx wanted, right? So it's all regulated. So, that was a big digression there, but certainly we have socialism in America. You just don't realize it, and people vote for it all the time. Now, Lincoln being friendly with Karl Marx is a big story because, it proves at the end of the day that we were all right about who Lincoln was, at least in his centralizing tendencies, that the war was really about centralization more than anything else. It was about power. This is one thing I say all the time. It's slavery and ending slavery is the popular way because it has to, look, we have to justify in some way the slaughter of nearly a million men. You have to justify that. And if it's just about, hey, look, the war was about saving the Union and creating a stronger central government, no one would support that. So Lincoln knew it. Lincoln knew there had to be something else. Lincoln knew that, well, if I free the slaves, then everyone will look the other way about what's really going on here. Now, he never said that, but that's exactly what's happening, right? He had to keep the British and the French out of the war, so he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, which, by the way, didn't free the slaves in the North. We all know that. And Delaware didn't have end slavery till December of 1865. Maryland only did it in 1864, a year after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. So we know that it didn't free slaves in the slave states that were still in the Union, right? So we had, I remember there was an exchange I saw on YouTube where an idiot kept saying that that we didn't have two slaveholding republics fighting each other. We didn't? Are you sure? In 1861, we had two slaveholding republics fighting each other. The United States was still a slaveholding republic, federal republic. It still was. Well, I mean, you could say it was a slaveholding national government by that point, but still was. You still had slaves in Maryland and Delaware and Kentucky, which Lincoln claimed was in the Union. Missouri, which Lincoln claimed was in the Union. You still had them there. In fact, Lincoln rejected efforts to free slaves in Missouri. So it was two slaveholding republics fighting each other over slavery. Wait, that doesn't make any sense, does it? No, it doesn't. But I want to get into this piece. I've rambled on here for a few minutes about this, and there's, I get into all this stuff. If you want my views on the war, take my War for Southern Independence class at McClanahan Academy. That's an awesome class, too. It's my bestseller. And so get that class. I get into all these issues there in great detail. And I also talk about it in my new survey course. Not as in much detail, but it is a survey course. So it's what you would get if you were taking a college course on the topic of United States history to 1865. But let's get into this. Piece. So you know who was into Karl Marx? Not AOC, Abraham Lincoln. He was into Karl Marx, right? So the two men were friendly and influenced each other. To the author, Gillian Brockell, I guess that is, Brockell, B-R-O-C-K-E-L-L, Brockell. This is a badge of honor. Again, Washington Post, July 27, 2019. It was December 1861, a Tuesday at noon, when President Abraham Lincoln sent his first annual message, what later became the State of the Union, to the House and Senate. By the next day, all 7,000 words of the manuscript were published in newspapers across the country, including the Confederate South. Well, that's not really the country at that point, is it? This was Lincoln's first chance to speak to the nation at length since his inaugural address. The nation. Wasn't a nation. To the Federal Republic, if we're staying under the Constitution. Of course, the Confederate South was the Confederacy, a whole other country. He railed against the disloyal citizens rebelling against the Union, touted the strength of the Army and Navy, and updated Congress on the budget. For his eloquent closer, he chose not a soliloquy on unity or freedom, but an 800-word meditation on what the Chicago Tribune subtitled Capital versus Labor. Labor is prior to and independent of capital, the country's 16th president said. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. If you think that sounds like something Karl Marx would write, well, that might be because Lincoln was regularly reading Karl Marx. So this is an argument that the left often makes today. If there's no labor, if you don't have workers, you don't have capital. And if you don't have capital, if you don't have workers, well, I mean, how are you going to produce stuff? Well, the point is you can't have the workers without the capital. Right now, I mean, I understand to get the capital in the first place, there has to be some work done. Something has to happen. But, you know, without the capital, laborers don't exist. And we know this. We know that laborers don't create jobs. Capital does. So, you know, which came, the chicken or the egg? But certainly the innovation, the spirit. I mean, yes, somebody with the vision has to be able to acquire the capital and get the capital and go forward with that. And labor is required to do these things, but eventually capital, I mean, look, capital is necessary. There is no wealthy country in the world ever that's followed the model that Lincoln is advocating here where wealth comes from the bottom up. It cannot. It cannot be produced from the bottom up. Now, we can look at things like farmers, independent farmers. If you're looking at an agrarian republic, well, then, of course, the object there is not necessarily wealth creation, it's independence, and it's a whole nother ballgame. But when you're talking about simple capital, well, without capital, you don't have labor, and contrary to what Lincoln or Marx has to say. President Trump has added a new arrow in his quiver of attacks of late, charging that a vote for any Democrat in the next election is a vote for the rise of radical socialism. And that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other congresswomen of color are a bunch of communists. Yet the first Republican president for whom Trump has expressed admiration was surrounded by socialists and looked to them for counsel. I mean, again, this is Brockell. This is a badge of honor now. Now, when the Kennedys, Ronnie and Donnie Kennedy, who wrote the famous or infamous book, The South Was Right, they published a book, I can't remember, it's Lincoln's Red Republicans or anyways, getting into this idea of communists, and there's been some others, they've always been considered fringe books. But what Brockell is saying, no, this stuff is right. He's validating it all. Of course, Lincoln was not a socialist, nor a communist or a Marxist. Just as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer aren't. Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders identify as Democratic socialists. But Lincoln and Marx, born only 9 years apart, were contemporaries. They had mutual friends, read each other's work, and in 1865, exchanged letters. Yes, Marx admired Abraham Lincoln. When Lincoln served his sole term in Congress in the late 1840s, the young lawyer from Illinois became close friends with Horace Greeley, a fellow Whig who served briefly alongside him. Greeley was better known as the founder of the New York Tribune, the newspaper largely responsible for transmitting the ideas and ideals that formed the Republican Party in 1854. And what were those ideas and ideals? They were anti-slavery, pro-worker, and sometimes overtly socialist, according to Josh Nichols, author of the book The S-Word, A Short History of the American Tradition, Socialism. The New York Tribune championed the redistribution of land in the American West to the poor and the emancipation of slaves. Greeley welcomed the disapproval of those who championed free markets over the interests of the working class, a class he recognized as including both the oppressed slaves of the South and the degraded industrial laborers of the North, Nichols writes. Now, this is interesting when you get into the attack on capitalism. Southerners were also attacking capitalism. This is why Greeley, in 1872, Greeley was the liberal Republican, and there were some Southerners that voted for Greeley because they saw in Greeley at least an attack on that Northeastern industrial capitalism that they had railed against themselves. And the South always said, look, those people in the Northeast, to Westerners, those people in the Northeast are not your friends. They're not your friends. They don't have the same view about society as you have. But they were controlling the Republican Party by 1872. This is the Hamiltonian system, which is what Henry Clay wanted. Now, the only thing the West got out of that were internal improvements and Western land. But see, the Republicans were willing to sell that land for basically nothing. Now, Southerners had long opposed that idea because they thought the revenue would help keep the tariff down. But anyways, we're getting to all that. That's in the weeds stuff. But it's interesting how, you know, this is portrayed. Across the Atlantic, another man linked the fate of enslaved and wage workers, Marx. Upon publishing the Communist Manifesto with Frederick Engels in 1848, the German philosopher sought refuge in London after a failed uprising in what was then the German Confederation. Hundreds of thousands of German radicals immigrated to the United States in the same period, filling industrial jobs in the North and joining anti-slavery groups. Marx had once considered going west himself to Texas, something to historian Robin Blackburn in his book, something according to, well, that's, this thing got cut off. Stupid internet. I don't have that. So Robert Blackburn obviously said something, but I don't know what it was. Marx was intensely interested in the plight of American slaves. In January 1860, he told Engels that the two biggest things happening in the world were on the one hand, the movement of the slaves in America started by the death of John Brown, and on the other, the movement of the serfs in Russia. He equated Southern slaveholders with European aristocrats, Blackburn writes, and thought ending chattel slavery would not destroy capitalism but would create conditions far more favorable to organizing and elevating labor, whether white or black. So, the South, I mean, this is interesting too because, again, you get into the antebellum South. Yes, the South was, quote-unquote, aristocratic. It was cavalier. I mean, the culture of the South had been formed that way. Now, not all of it. You had the Celtic influence in the West, but certainly it was important. Marx was also friends with Charles A. Dana, an American socialist. This is one reason why I don't know why conservatives attack the South the way they do. It's, I mean, when you're promoting Abraham Lincoln, this is clear, you're promoting the left of the 1860s. So are you a leftist? Are you a dedicated socialist? It's a question you should ask the neoconservatives because, and then of course, when you push neoconservative foreign policy, you're pushing progressives like Woodrow Wilson. So what are you? Are you really a conservative or are you a progressive? I mean, really what we have are two shades of progressivism in the general government. That's what we have. We don't really have a conservative opposition. It doesn't exist. I mean, whether you agree with that or not, it's just a fact. You don't have a conservative opposition, a real conservative opposition. Marx is also friends with Charles A. Dana, an American socialist fluent in German, who was a managing editor of the New York Tribune. In 1852, Dana hired Marx to be the newspaper's British correspondent. Over the next decade, Marx wrote nearly 500 articles for the paper. Many of his contributions became unsigned columns appearing on the front page of the publication's official position. Marx later borrowed liberally from his New York Tribune writings in his book Capital, according to Nichols. The New York Tribune also had a person there named George Ripley. And George Ripley is an interesting character. Now, if you go to Encyclopedia Britannica online, this is what they say about George Ripley. Now, this is to show you the bias, even of a quote-unquote encyclopedia, an unbiased source. Charles Ripley, journalist and reformer whose life for half a century mirrored the main currents of American thought. It did? It mirrored the main currents of American thought? My gosh. He was a leading promoter and director of Brook Farm, the celebrated utopian community at West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Celebrated. People thought this thing was kooky. This is written by the editors of Encyclopedia Britannica. Not even the people that went there thought it was kooky eventually. It burned the thing down. But no, it's celebrated. He mirrored the main currents of American thought. Really? He was a spokesman for the utopian socialist ideas of the French social reformer Charles Fourier. Fourier was a nut. But that's the main currents of American thought. Ripley became literary critic for the New York Tribune, and his articles and reviews were widely syndicated. He was an arbiter of taste and culture for much of the reading public. Didn't mean they agreed with him. I mean, maybe in New England. I don't know. But Brook Farm, this is what Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote about in The House of Seven Gables. He had spent time at Brook Farm. He thought this place was silly. It's a communist utopia that didn't work. Ripley was reared as an Orthodox Congregationalist, but he entered the Unitarian ministry after graduating from Harvard Divinity School while pastor at Boston's Purchase Street Church. He was a member of the Transcendentalist Club and the editor of The Dial, the prototypical little magazine. So he's a Transcendentalist and Unitarian. I mean, this is Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is Henry David Thoreau. These people are kooks, right? They're crazy. In 1841, Ripley left the pulpit to found Brook Farm. For the next 6 years, he directed Brook Farm, promoted Fourier's ideas. Now, Fourier had an idea that he called phalanxes, and because this is a kid-friendly show, I'm not going to get into what that is, but I'll just say this. Part of the main thrust of phalanxes was not to have traditional Christian marriages. I'll just say that. Ripley was himself in dire financial straits, but determined to pay off the remaining Brook Farm debts. They burned the thing to the ground. He took a job with Horace Greeley's New York Tribune as a book reviewer, city news writer, and translator of foreign news dispatches. His financial position remained precarious until the publication of the Cyclopedia, a widely acclaimed reference book that he co-edited. As a literary critic, Ripley was cautious, scholarly, and courteous. He was commonly judged the ablest critic of his day. He wrote one of the few popular reviews of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. That book was considered crazy by most Americans when it came out. He wasn't a mirror of the main currents of American thought. He was a fringe socialist radical. I mean, think of this article. All these people were. These people were fringe socialist radicals. But this is exactly what the South, after the war, is pointing out. You've got your war, now the war is over, and look at what you've got running things. This is what R.L. Dabney was saying. The war is going to unleash, it's going to open this Pandora's box of socialism and all the other isms that are going to come out of the North. Because he could see it all. It was already there. Like a lot of nascent Republicans, Lincoln was an avid reader of the Tribune. It nearly guaranteed that in the 1850s, Lincoln was regularly reading Marx. In 1860, two major factors helped to propel Lincoln to the Republican nomination for the presidency. First, the support of Furman German revolutionaries who had become key players in the Republican Party. And second, the support of the party's newspaper, the Tribune. So here is Brock L. essentially agreeing with the Kennedys. Lincoln counted on the socialist vote. This is why when Lincoln is shown at the American Communist Party as their guy, a big image of Lincoln, they're right. Once Lincoln took office, his alliance with socialists didn't stop. Dana left the Tribune to become Lincoln's eyes and ears in the War Department, following along with troop movements and telling Lincoln what he thought of his generals. A soldier working in the telegraph office later wrote that Lincoln waited eagerly for Dana's long dispatches. And Greeley continued to urge Lincoln to take a harder line against slavery, to make the Civil War not just about preserving the Union, but about abolition. Marx did the same thing in the pages of the Tribune. So here's Lincoln being dragged, and he's saying, yeah, but see, Lincoln understood that this had to be a war aim, because it had to be a war aim, because just saving the Union wasn't enough. That nobody could justify slaughtering people to save the Union later on. In 1863, they got what they wanted when Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. In January 1865, Marx wrote to Lincoln on behalf of the International Workmen's Association, a group of four socialists, communists, anarchists, and trade unionists, to congratulate the American people upon your re-election. He said, quote, an oligarchy of 300,000 slaveholders has defiled the republic, and that the working men of Europe feel sure that, as of the American War for Independence, she had initiated a new era of ascendancy for the middle class, so the American anti-slavery war would do for the working class. I mean, you almost can't make it. Look, this is amazing. Now, again, this is being championed as a good thing that Lincoln was a socialist, or at least dabbled with socialism. It's not. A few weeks later came a reply from Charles Francis Adams, son of the former president, John Quincy Adams. He told Marx that Lincoln had received his message, and it was accepted by him with a sincere and anxious desire that he may be able to prove himself not unworthy of the confidence which has been recently extended to him by his fellow citizens and by so many of the friends of humanity and progress throughout the world. Notably, Adams indicated Lincoln considered Marx and company friends. He wanted to say that the Union, quote, derives new encouragement to persevere from the testimony of the working men of Europe. Both letters ran in newspapers across Britain and the United States. Marx was delighted, telling Engels it created such a sensation that the bourgeoisie and private clubs were shaking their heads at it. Lincoln also met with the New York chapter of the Working Men's Association, telling its members in 1864, the strongest bond of human sympathy outside of the family relation should be the one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues and kindreds, which is perhaps a more eloquent rendering of Marx's famous rallying cry, workers of the world unite. Lincoln never took up the mantle of socialism. He believed in the system of wage labor and even proposed reforms to it. Marx rejected it as another form of slavery. But Lincoln certainly viewed socialists as allies, and Nichols writes, it is indisputable that the Republican Party had at its founding a red streak. Though this fact may be little known now, less because people don't read us. I mean, look, you want to know the truth, just follow people like me and Tom Woods and Kevin Gutzman and anything we do with that stuff. You want to know the truth, just follow us. We've been pointing this stuff out for years. Tom DiLorenzo, for years. Been called kooks, crazy people, y'all just crazy. No. We've been telling you this stuff. It hasn't been a secret to figures in American history. When the socialist orator and frequent presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs made a campaign stop in Springfield, Illinois in 1908, he told the crowd the Republican Party was once red. Lincoln was a revolutionary. It was also noted by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in February 1968 at a celebration of life of W.B. Du Bois. King brought up that the co-founder of the NAACP became a communist in his later years. It is worth noting, King said, that Abraham Lincoln warmly welcomed the support of Karl Marx during the Civil War and corresponded with him freely. Our irrational, obsessive anti-communism has led us into too many quagmires to be retained as if it were a mode of scientific thinking. So there you have it. Lincoln, I mean, the Washington Post has said it now, so Lincoln was dabbled with Marxism. Because the Washington Post said it, it's true. Forget about everything we've ever said, but now we know it's true because, again, the Post is the major thought paper of the day, right? And they're celebrating it. So now Alexandria Ocasio, I mean, I love it because it does rib the neoconservatives. It is fun to drive this in them. You know, you're not really conservative. You're just supporting the leftists, that people like AOC do have a better claim to Lincoln than you do, unless you really want to be a centralizer. And I mean, if that's what you want, I mean, I agree with them. I've agreed with them for years on this particular position. So, you know, Lincoln is he's in my book, Nine Presidents Who Screwed Up America. The most flack I got from that was when I went on neoconservative talk shows and they had not read the book, but they saw Abraham Lincoln was there and they went ballistic. How can you say that? Abraham Lincoln's the greatest guy ever. Abraham Lincoln saved the Union. Abraham Lincoln was a conservative. He was? Are you sure about that? Because he sure didn't sound like it in 1864 or 63 or 62 or 61 even. He didn't really sound like that. Not conserving the original Constitution. And he certainly wrote, now Lincoln was a chameleon in a lot of ways, but he certainly wrote things that didn't sound very conservative. But we're just a bunch of kooks, right? So I hope you enjoyed this takedown of Abraham Lincoln, the socialist. Of course, the Washington Post is propping him up as a socialist. That was a lot of fun. I'll see you next time on The Brian McClain Show.